up or sharp enough to just get up and start speaking, making a speech on some philosophical aspect. So we want to apologize to everyone, particularly our students that came in from Midwestern State University. But it's just one of those things. It hasn't happened in quite a while. I don't think that this has happened. But what we wanted to do tonight, and of course there's no charge and all that, we wanted to get your impression, your ideas on what kind of speakers you'd like, what type of topics that you would like to hear. Yes?
Can we get the music turned off?
Yes.
Martin, can we get the music turned down?
Yeah, off the loop. We might have to ask him about the 7:30 start.
Yeah,
we're ready.
Yeah.
We can't have a meeting about a topic. Maybe several people could contribute.
Yeah. So what we do, we'd like to bring up a couple of points. First off, the main question I have is, where can I get a tie just like that?
Sure.
You're styling, Mr. Jack. I'll wait for them to turn the music down.
Don't feel bad for us. We were going to be in Dallas.
All right, well,
so
I appreciate that.
Is Jane, and you can talk about Jane.
Yes, no connection. He wasn't the founder of
probably a little bit of an ethnic connection there.
Yeah, ethnic connection, exactly. So, Martin, can we turn the sound and music off in this room? And actually, the third thing I'd like to talk about are starting time, topics for philosophy, and then I'd like to hear a little bit about the Midwestern State University, some of the classes you guys are taking. I think that'd be pretty interesting. And what are some of the classes? Oh, there we go.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
So, all right. So actually, let's start off with this on our start time. We were at 7:30, and then we thought, well, perhaps that we would encourage people because the restaurant closes at 9, right? 9 o'clock. So the idea was that to encourage people to stay longer and to socialize, and then we should start at 7 o'clock, and the speaker goes till 8 or so, and then an hour for discussion and socializing and all that. But for me, it's just kind of hard to make it here by 7 p.m. And I don't know what you all think. Do you like the 7 p.m. start time or the 7:30 p.m. start time?
7:30.
Who likes 7:30? Okay.
Who likes 7?
Who likes 7?
It's kind of half and half.
7:15.
Okay, so we're going to have a board meeting on Sunday. We're going to talk about that. So sometimes it's difficult for the speakers to get here, and I just know that I know several board members, they had difficulty getting here. Traffic, and that's just the holiday weekend. The second thing is we'd like to get your thoughts on the types of speakers that like the type of topics. I know some people have mentioned to me that maybe we've had too many religious topics. So what are some of your inclinations or your areas that are most interesting? Yes, Jack.
The role of culture and how it makes it hard to detect the effects of evolution in humans.
Okay. Culture and evolution. So sort of science and
right. And art, the role of art.
Art, okay.
Which is part of culture, and what does it do for us?
Right.
Less on the spiritual.
And what do you think that art does for us, Jack?
It makes life more livable. It prevents us from killing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because it caters to our tendency toward delusion.
And
partially fulfills it. And it's not that.
Well, I know, like, for me, going to an art museum or listening to the Beatles' White Album, it just gives me this feeling of, oh, this is so exciting. You know, look what look what our species can do. Look at what we're capable of, or seeing a Van Gogh, or it adds this moment of excitement, exhilaration, that what art, what these artists can do, it just is like a great scientific discovery. So it, to me, it adds to the excitement and vibrancy and color of life. David?
Anthropologically or paleontologically speaking, art was probably the earliest, 30,000 years ago, those cave paintings.
In France.
Exquisite. And whether they had any religious significance or what, they certainly came before organized religion.
Right.
So art may have been our very first expression of transcendence, something beyond.
Right. Okay, so art and culture and mentioned science. What about political philosophy or political philosophy? Okay. Not politics per se, but there's so many areas of political philosophy that are, politics will just end up getting in big fights. You know? But I mean, some of the political philosophies.
From religion to politics, out of the frying pan.
That's right. That's right. So we have tried to contact, I know I have, and I think a few other board members have tried to contact some professors at SMU that focus on sort of in the political philosophy. We haven't had much luck doing that. One of our challenges is finding speakers and such.
We can always get you an
anarchist. We've had...
Have you had Jolson from SMU?
Yes, we've had Cal Jolson speak. Yeah, absolutely. What we try to do is get the speakers, get a break, so like every 2 or 3 years, we'll try and get a speaker back.
Well, that brings up another question. Maybe you have some suggestions for somebody who has some suggestions for speakers. Well, yes, I can give some names, but I'd like to hear people in a field who are willing to speculate about what they see ahead.
Sort of
to hold them to much.
So sort of a futuristic look at.
Yeah.
Okay.
What may happen down the road that they see emerging.
So I've been reading a little bit about this. It's a very interesting point. It's Jerry, right? Your name's Jerry. Yeah, Jerry. Has anybody ever heard the phrase amped individual? Anybody heard that phrase?
Yeah.
Well, I have a friend who has Parkinson's disease, and so they did this neurological implant into his brain. They drilled a hole into his brain, into his head, in the skull, and they implanted this neurological implant. It's like a chip. It was like the size of an aspirin, right on the edge of his brain. And this has a couple, two or three computer chips, and they have these silicone chips that have like 100 million transistors on them, okay? So they can communicate, they can talk to the brain. It modulates the brain, the electrical impulses of the brain, and this is starting to be used as like a pacemaker for the brain. It's going to be starting to be used for epileptics, and so people with Parkinson's as well. Well, what happens if we find that there's a way to make someone smarter or make someone's memory better, and there's no disability per se, in 20 or 30 years, you could have, or longer, you could have like an enhanced individual. It's a combination of biological and non-biological intelligence. And so it's like the South African sprinter, what was his name, that was arrested. He has that prosthetic.
Pistorius.
Yeah, Pistorius. Oscar Pistorius. And he made the semifinals with this prosthetic. It was a neuroprosthetic because it was tied in, I don't know if it was tied into a neurological implant, I don't think it was, but down the road, there will be those types of things. So, like the futurism, if you can have these quote-unquote amped individuals that have an advantage over other people that don't have this, then there's all sorts of philosophical ramifications for computer technology and all.
And also ethically.
Ethically, yeah.
They can whether we manipulate type of genes, or we do repair work, or we do enhancement work.
Yeah.
Oh, the enhancement.
Right.
Can go into all sorts of directions.
That's right. That's right. So, so futurology, the certain area then. Okay. Very good. That's a big, and the Library of Congress, when there started to be more and more futurist books written, they had to try to decide, how are we going to categorize this? Because they couldn't figure out how to categorize it. So they finally categorized it in the area of history, because it was like reverse history. Just sort of the... any ideas on who arguably was the very first futurist?
Futurist.
Jules Verne was one of them, but going back to
Michelangelo or
Da Vinci. Has anybody seen Da Vinci's drawings?
Yes.
Unbelievable. Helicopters, submarines, automobiles, like a form of skyscraper.
Parachutes,
yeah. Adding machines, yeah. Hang glider, yeah. Amazing. And then Jules Verne's what was very, very much a futurist.
I don't count him or Tesla because I think they were sent back.
Nostradamus. So what do you know about Nostradamus, sir?
Well, he made predictions, He didn't exactly rival Da Vinci, but he was of that ilk.
Yeah. What era was he? I forgot. Da Vinci was like 15th century, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
Nostradamus was 13th,
14th. Okay. Late 1400s. Late 1400s, okay. So he was in the Renaissance then. So, yeah. Yes, sir?
I want to say that I think a lot of the good philosophy lectures I've heard here weren't actually given by philosophers per se working in philosophy.
Yeah.
They were given by either doctors or scientists working in areas that hinged on philosophical issues. There's something on NPR over the weekend that I heard. There was like an entire hour of special cases that deal with the human mind. That if you're exerting the body and mind to extreme forces, like G, this level of, mach this, then basically it doesn't just affect your face and, push your face.
Exactly.
It actually affects the way you think.
Yep.
And they were making arguments for the idea that there's a brief window for some of these guys where they're seeing the same tunnel of light that people claim they see sometimes when they're having a near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, that maybe that's just the brain being too confused to operate, and so thinking it was a little bit worse.
Right.
But I mean, things like that, we can get into epistemology and metaphysics somewhat about how things work.
Right.
In tandem with the mind, but also maybe even the ethics kind of things you mentioned too, in terms of potential ethical issues.
Well, we have a professor, I forgot his name, we're going to have the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Ethics. He's going to be speaking in the spring. So I wish I would remember his name. Jack?
Well, the phenomenon about these accidental genes, I can't remember the name of it, but we've heard about the guy who could memorize everything.
Idiot Savant?
Yeah.
But just a guy who, he taught absolutely, sounds normal, but he memorized pi 22,000 places.
Yeah.
And then he thought he'd learned the hardest language there is, which is Icelandic. 2 weeks.
Yeah. But he's totally lacking in social skills, probably.
No, he's not.
Oh, is that right?
He's normal as far as I can tell.
Because usually there's a lack of emotional intelligence.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have lack of emotional intelligence.
Is that right?
He can read people's emotions. The guy is astounding. It's weird.
There's a thing they call infinite intelligence, or infinite memory at least, where, apparently some very normal people and very socially adept and very physically attractive people marry even Hannah.
Yeah.
One of these people, nobody would say she's socially maladept or unattractive or nerd men's case, stereotypically. And she got this infinite, she literally remember, day 300 yards.
Right.
Days ago.
30 years ago, she moved. There was a 60-minute show on that, wasn't there? It was 60 minutes. But she was the only one of these 8 or 9 people that could remember what she was doing 35 years, 2 months, and 4 days ago, she was the only one that had, that was able to maintain a long-term relationship. All the others had all sorts of difficulties in relationships in Minnesota.
Well, yeah, it helps to be able to forget things, right?
Yeah.
That's what you were doing back then.
Yeah, yeah. I'm finding that it gets down to that. I know exactly what you said 3 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago.
Yeah.
No, I know what you said.
That's right.
How many normal people have difficult relationships?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Okay, these are some great ideas. Any other ideas?
He could suddenly write music, see the music in his mind. He had never taken lessons or anything, but it is a special thing that actually, he couldn't help but compose. It was pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not just in your mind, that's one thing. But his hands could do it. That's what amazes me. The motor part, he suddenly had his fingers.
Right. But if you get smarter and smarter, we all want to be smarter and smarter, or better looking, or better looking. If you take that to the extreme, isn't there some point where the negatives outweigh the positives? When you get or richer, or smarter, or better looking, and at some point, you could want to argue that it turns into a disadvantage.
I'd like to answer that at some level. I'm a private tutor in my professional life, and I tutor a great many classes of people. Occasionally, a number of my athletes are concussed, or they're double concussed, from one of their athletes. And if you do not know, the entirety of the college system is built towards the athlete.
Right. So oh, yeah.
I didn't know this getting into this, but if you could throw like a ball,
yeah.
Like,
right.
Or like, yeah.
Then professors and teachers will make exceptions for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Double concussed. Still goes to the top of the college. However, I also deal with these top 5% and top 4% and top 2 and 1% intelligences. These kids get checks in the mail. Because they think they're in their sophomore year without studying and so on and so forth. Or they'll be in a family. One was a National Merit Scholar. The other one didn't want to bother. That sort of stuff. And my question is always how, because I deal with them in this very, very structured format, but how do they deal with each other? Because I tell you, if you talk to a top, even the differences between a top 5% and a top 1% are so enormous that if they want to see the same movie or read the same book, they have seen two different movies.
Yeah.
They have seen two different books. And my question is, first of all, and what I was hoping to ask you, Jane, is there any sort of like advantages that these top 5%, top 2%, top 1% have that they can see so much more clearly and so much more fidelity the universe around us, right? That they can manipulate.
As far as intelligence?
Yeah, as far as just generic base intelligences, mm-hmm. Right? And importantly, I also occasionally see these, typically if you're going to see a top 1%, there's a long route ahead of it, one parent at Yale, one parent at Goldman Sachs,
yeah.
One, somebody's State Department, something. But, occasionally you see these feral cats, right? this 15-year-old who can work out, the square root of 500 in real time to 2 or 3 decimal places, right? And so on and so forth, but they are mean, and they are cruel.
Yeah.
And they would feel better having acquired something precious about them. And that's my curious thing is how does the Jane deal with predators or freeloaders or parasites in the community, right? Or these other characters who not only would be parasites on us, but would be fantastically adept at it, right? That's always my question.
Mm-hmm.
I have a semi-answer to that. I've had to struggle with most of my life because it seemed to me that if you we're always trying to love your neighbor as yourself, even if they're your enemies and that kind of thing. If you took that to the extreme, then you wouldn't be cross-subsidizing evil people.
Yeah.
And you don't want to do that because evil will take over. In my humble opinion, I had always suspected that the fact that Christ had talked about going to the second mile and not, say, the 77th mile, like people talk about with forgiveness. But if you're just talking about helping your enemies or not just loving them, but even going the second mile for them. There's a limit on it. You go, you do something extra for them, and they'll be blown away by it.
Yeah.
Actually, being nice to me, I'm an a-hole to them. Maybe these Christian people are different. But there's a limit where, you don't just let yourself get used
doctors, so that you have our process, I speak to the guys who are literal cats, as you know, that will exploit you. And I bounced this off of a high guy, because I thought that would be an interesting thing to see what he'd say about other religions. He says, you know, it's amazing what you're saying about that, because I also brought up Buddhism with him, you know, and how, like, with Buddhism, they seem, you know, one big thing with Baha'is is they'll say that most of the major religions had some very good insights, but they went off in extremes in various ways. And I would say when you set yourself on fire at the protests in Vietnam, that's a pretty extreme form of self-abnegation. And I thought, maybe that Christians have done sort of the same thing, but maybe there was some way in which Buddhism, like my second mile theory, had a limit also, but that they kind of got away from that limit thing and were just setting themselves on fire.
Right.
And he said, you know, it's amazing you bring that up, because I can't remember where it is, but I know there was a conversation that's written down where it's an interview with, you know, teaching of Buddha, where they asked him, Buddha, what do you do when you have somebody who gives evil towards you? What would you return that with? And he said, return it with love.
Yeah.
He says, yeah, but what if you then give him love and he keeps giving you evil, what do you return that with? And it said in the text that it actually said, Buddha leaned forward and then said, with firmness. So in other words, what I'm saying is I think most of the major religions, if you go back to the original teachings, sort of believe in a second mile theory. But there's a limit where you don't keep cross-subsidizing the enemy if they're
You don't want yourself to be taken advantage of, but you don't want to enable others. I mean, just think about a child that becomes very, very dependent, and you give that child this and that, and at some point you are hindering that child when you're helping that child.
Well, have you read Walter Link? He has a theory about the second mile. He said that the Romans were able to grab anybody along the side of the road and make them carry their stuff,
but only
for 1 mile.
Right.
So you say, well, I'll carry it the second mile. Then you turn that soldier, who's your oppressor, into somebody begging you not to turn your stuff for the second mile, because now they'll be in trouble.
Oh, I see, because they'd be in trouble.
And so it's a third way, like the third way is like, you know,
You know, we were talking about what you were talking about just a second ago about going the second mile, and what Rob was saying about, you know, there's a limit, and you were saying there's a limit, and I really think that's true, but we tend to look at it as like an individual one-on-one kind of relationship, but if you look at it as like a system, you know, we're trying to maintain a system that lets everybody thrive. So when you overbalance something over here, it screws up the system. And that's, so what you have to look for is like spiritual growth in different people. You know, and when it becomes something where they're not growing but regressing, you need to like back off. But anyway, it's more about...
The thing is that the second mile theory not only helps other people and maybe turns them into decent people when they're freaked out or embarrassed by your kindness towards them, but it's kind of good for you, too, because when you do a second mile thing for a lot of people, they tend to, like, repay that with love and not continue evil.
Yeah, but if you keep enabling somebody and they end up with some really bad habits, it's time to back off.
No, not evil people or parasites, but I mean, there are a lot of other people who say, hey, that was a good guy. I'd kind of like to, you know, be in business with him. And, you know, there's a quote by Zig Ziglar that says, there is no traffic jam on the highway of success on that second mile. When I saw that, I actually laughed in class when I saw this. I was like, oh my God, that's it.
Did you have something, Jared? It looked like you were raising your hand. Okay. Sorry about that. David?
How about more on the neuroscience?
Uh-huh.
You know, the brain is the last frontier.
Right. Cognitive research.
And really, you know, exploding that information, that knowledge. Maybe even philosophy of mind. That's not true.
Well, we have, I think I'm trying to line up a philosopher from maybe UD on the philosophy of the mind. So.
But on the other hand, some real science, too. Neurology. Neurologic science.
Yeah, yeah.
And along with neurologists, psychologists, evolutionary anthropologists.
Right,
there you go.
Really good, a couple good ideas.
I was just at the American Society of Criminology. My wife is very interesting, but there's this guy there who's an evolutionist, and he's a neuroscientist. of experimentalists, and he looks at fMRI along with EEG,
yeah,
and the other one, PET scans, and he not only, usually you just see hot spots.
Yeah.
Doing this lights up. But this guy claims it's possible to see the links between the different parts of the brain, and he's built up a theory of networks, interconnected networks. He claims that he can actually see information flowing, and he says yes. And the guy's absolutely brilliant. He's if there's other guys like him, if that's for real, you know, that would be something.
Okay. So an interest in science and neuroscience.
How the brain works mechanically, more detailed.
It's replete with philosophical ramifications and stuff like that.
I'll put a little plug in for that. In February, my subject here is going to be how and why religion.
The development of religion, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of that is going to have neuroscience in it. You know, that the brain is plugged,
right,
to be programmed, you know, for
religion. And isn't that sort of related to like the survivalist, hard times, belief in something bigger than yourself that gives you the power and the fortitude to continue on a very difficult and treacherous path?
We'll talk about that. Andrew Newberry, you know, that did the book Why God Won't Go Away.
Yeah.
You know, there's PET scans and whatever with people who meditate and also religious people, nuns who did a kind of a channeling prayer type thing. And he you know, mapped their blood flow and their brain and what lights up and, you know, during these things that the brain is wired to appreciate God.
Yeah.
Or vice versa, God wires the brain.
So we're talking about neuroscience
and there's a lot of neuroscience there.
Right. And Brian, you're a professor at UTD in the science realm. Do you have any contacts there that you might be able to help us with? We can talk about that later on.
I don't think of any right at the moment.
Okay, good.
What about cosmology?
Yeah.
What about cosmology? Lots of stuff going on in dark matter.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, this other subject, what about, we've had speakers here talking about like the origin of French law, which I thought was fascinating. And then other things about how law developed in some ways. I mean, you know, origins of things is really interesting.
Right.
And also things like the philosophical underpinnings of historical events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why a historical event happened the way it did because different people were coming at it from different ways.
Okay.
I mean, those kind of things. I mean, history is rich with stuff.
I was going to take up a little bit on the neuroscience. Adult developmental psychology is the social application of some of these things that we're learning. That might have a lot of different models for that.
Right.
And of course, we all tend to think of child developmental psychology, but the science of adult developmental psychology is really quite an interesting subject to me, anyway. It's a very mature science.
There's a book out that deals with somewhat on that called Habits. Has anybody heard the book Habits?
Mm-hmm.
About how we develop bad habits, but if we can replace these bad habits with good habits, find the right motivation. So this gets into sort of like motivational theory, which is tied into neuroscience.
Probably the most popular model is spiral dynamics, which I don't know if you've talked about that either.
We have gone back to speak to this group, but it's been about probably 7 years that he's actually addressed this group.
There'll be someone for us to look into contacting again. I don't know.
Yeah, he might be willing to come back when he's in town. He travels a lot.
We had
a speaker that spoke on history, on big history. Does history or any aspect appeal to anybody?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
I was kind of thinking. Maybe so, any aspect,
maybe it's just money that you might think.
Yes.
One aspect of that, you might think at first, well, that's trivial, that's just history, it's nice to know history, but that's not really philosophy. But in fact, you start to think about issues like, well, it's the victors in a war that write the history of it, now it's art. It does get into areas of, well, what kind of history do you write, and you know, like, how does that, quote, history, unquote, change over time in terms of people's retellings of it, sometimes with certain agendas to grind, other times purely due to popular trends having nothing to do with ideological axis, right? Just, you know, that is a kind of interesting topic.
Right, and that gets into the whole issue we were talking about earlier, is the truth. What do you mean by the truth? So if you read a history book on the Civil War, do you now understand the truth of the Civil War?
Well, I mean, the fact that you use in terms of Civil War means you have a particular bias.
Exactly. And
this part of the country.
Yeah, today, and so it's been described as...
War of Northern Depression.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's been described, when you read history, it's like it's someone that goes out fishing, okay? And they throw their rod, their line out there, and they catch a fish. And it's there in a gigantic ocean. So this is the one fish they have. It's kind of like that when you pick a history book to read.
Right. Yeah.
That's just one fish... One historical fish in that ocean of history.
Uh-huh.
And it gets into what's called the half-life of facts, and is this really a fact, and is that a fact, or is that a theory? What's the differentiation between a fact and a theory and a scientific law?
Where does interpretation start? Where does fact leave off? Does interpretation begin?
Where does interpretation begin?
Southeastern Europe is a really good example of where you don't just say tomato, tomato, okay? I mean, like, you've got a name of a whole country that they won't even allow to be called Macedonia. It has to be the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia for all sorts of political reasons involving Greece. And then you've got Kosovo, as everyone usually says, but not my ex-fiance from Albania.
Yeah.
It's Kosovo, you know, it's ours. It's, like we say that in Albanian, it's 90% Albanian. You do start to think, gee, 80% of the people in that country, 90% would call it Kosovo. Why does everyone keep calling it Kosovo? You know, so,
Exactly.
More subtle than you think sometimes.
Exactly. So what about our students from Midwestern State? We've got three of you here today?
Two,
okay. So what kinds of things, well first off, what, I'm curious, what drew you, you're both history and philosophy majors, right? What drew you to philosophy?
Well, actually, we don't have a philosophy major yet.
Okay.
We have a philosophy minor. We have a very small philosophy department. Dr. Jun, who you know,
runs
it. Luckily, we're getting a second professor in the fall.
Awesome.
So working our way towards maybe getting a major at some point.
Yeah.
We offer four classes a semester right now, so we're very limited. I'm minoring in philosophy, but I'm trying to take mini classes after the fact as I can.
What is your major?
History.
History, okay.
But I'm focusing mostly on philosophy. I'm hoping to graduate this week. But it's a very small department. What drew me is I was in the Army for a long time, and before that, I did a lot of pretty much studying on my own in high school. I was a very terrible high school student, but ideas had always interested me more than anything. And ever since I got out of the Army, I came here thinking I wanted to study English, and then I got a philosophy department.
Really
appealing to what I am always
going to do.
Awesome.
And then I convinced
her. What appeals to you about philosophy?
Well, ethics have always been a and then political philosophy. Things that I was interested in before I did political philosophy. So, I'm very interested in philosophy.
And you want to study philosophy in graduate school?
I want to.
Okay.
Midwestern Shaw College. I'm the president of the philosophy club at Midwestern. Actually, you guys inspired us to start our own lecture series in Wichita Falls.
Wonderful.
Because we have the artist lecture series on campus, which is just terrible. They get pseudo-celebrities and everyone that have money, you know, beyond belief to spend. And then we have the speakers initiative series, which is terrible. They never get any money for anything. And so we, Allie and I, primarily organize our own lecture series on campus with faculty, and we're hoping to get other faculty from other schools to come speak on not necessarily just philosophy, but intellectual discussion.
Sure.
And then the first one of these we came to, Dr. Roseman was speaking. I actually talked to him. I talked to him afterwards, and we're going to link up with their philosophy club and meetings.
Oh, wonderful. That's great.
I'm going to try to get contact with him again.
So we're making an impact. Dallas Foster's going to make an impact on future philosophers.
Well, the minds of our young. We've regularly had about 4 or 5 people come to every one of us since Dr. Roseman's lecture.
Yeah.
Today, beginning of Thanksgiving break, so we're in Dallas anyway. So
right.
We're kind of a city drop.
Yes. That makes it so great. And so, young lady, what were some of the things you like about philosophy?
Well, I'm in my first philosophy class.
She's a freshman semester.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm on the honors board who lives across hall from me. Uh-huh. And he, convinced me to, last minute take this ethics course.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And then I met Dr. Dunn, and then started going to philosophy club and doing a lot of philosophy things. And you know what? You're philosophy with liner now. And Dr. Dunn, gave me a piece of paper with my minor declaration form, and I'm like, yeah, okay. But I really like ethics, and I think it's, incredibly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And Midwestern is a really conservative school, and Dr. Dunn's not. And so it's an interesting, mixture of ideas and class.
There's not really any anarchists that are conservative.
Oh, that's true.
not with that attitude.
I'm a Republican anarchist. So
he says things that, freak people out in that class. And somebody, people quit because going to his class.
You get an email.
Right.
Really?
Your class is
challenging
my religious beliefs,
Wow.
So challenging the way you think. So,
And I thrive. I love it. We both love it.
I go to college and be challenged.
That's what
Dr. Jones was responding. Next semester, we're both taking the ancient philosophy course, the early modern philosophy course, and I'm actually going to be Dr. Jones' TA for his primary concerns of philosophy course and ethics course.
Right.
So trying to learn as much as we can. We're both interested in going to Purdue, which is where Dr. Dunn went, but they have a really cool program, a dual philosophy and literature program, which actually appeals to both of us, where you can start the philosophy program or the literature program, and then after 2 years, apply to this other program.
I have found over the years that the more I read philosophy and the more I read about science and history, the weaker my faith becomes. And I don't know if anyone else has that experience. Anyone else have that experience?
I would phrase that differently. I would say I have evolved in my spiritual life.
I see.
Lost.
A lot depends on how you define faith.
Yeah. Exactly.
A lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think a lot of people would agree that you said they're blind faith. The one problem with me is I never had blind faith. That was my whole problem. I've always been I think especially history. The more you read history, the more you realize what we think and what we believe is very arbitrary.
I just think the more you start to think for yourself instead of listening to what someone else is going to tell you. I was raised in a Christian home, but it was agnostic. I mean, nobody went to church, nobody did anything. So it was always a lot to make my own decision to think for myself, and I tried to become religious. I'm married, divorced. I tried to become religious, and I just found that I always believed in myself. Now there are people telling me this is what you have to think, this is what happens, this is how it happens. It doesn't work for me.
I don't know if the universities here have courses that I'm familiar with, philosophy of science or philosophy of social science. Anybody recognize this?
We're attempting to get, I think we're trying to get somebody to teach philosophy of
mind,
science, something.
Okay. I got a 14 degree in philosophy from the UW, and the most fun courses are the philosophy of science and the philosophy of mathematics.
That would be interesting.
That's something, David, if we had the philosophy of mathematics, huh?
I cannot remember that.
I think that would be very interesting.
That would be interesting.
That's exactly what that would entail. What do you do with philosophy of mathematics?
Well, they probably talk about, like, what numbers are. Are they, you know, real things? Why does the material world correspond with the ideal world?
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Some people call math the language of science.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. We talked about what's
it now. The exactitude of it.
The thing would be you get a mathematician or philosopher who can make it sentient,
symbolize
something that anybody could understand. And that's the hard part. You start talking about numbers and over, sort of quine and stuff like that, and it gets kind of extreme, but in some collectives. To make a long story short, with wine, you mentioned so-called Aristotelian logic. Ain't when you start talking about probability theory, that you can't really derive probability theory from so-called Aristotelian logic. And then, of course, with Gödel, you know, like the main thing is basically the idea that you can have these perfectly derived results is only true if you actually have pretty unsure assumptions, and if you have absolutely certain assumptions, you don't get all that sort of results and that, you know, but making that understandable to Wayne or a guy like me, that's
not where we had philosophy of science. As an ethical and religious question, this is something I deal with as a private tutor. Most of my business runs on referrals.
Uh-huh.
So if I, as an atheist, wanted to really, you know, double my income, I could go right down to McLean Bible Church. And within a year of this you know, expanding community, and probably double my income, right, as a non-believer, putting on this facade.
Right, but not being true to yourself.
Well, yeah, exactly. So where is the ethics in this? Yeah. Right, you know, as I say, I could probably really help people along in their faith, you know, and get them into much better schools, or secure them funding, and do all of these wonderful things for them, and absolutely,
But you'd be living a lie. You'd be harming yourself.
Plenty of people, D. Lord lived a lie. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, but plenty of people do live wise and do great things with it. Right. You know, this is your way to get where the ethics at.
Yes, we do what he died about a year ago of cancer, a brilliant debater. He would debate people of faith and the case of religion versus no religion. His thing is religion is just bad.
Hitchens.
Yeah, Christopher Hitchens.
He was true to himself. He was like the black knight of religion. And people, the churches would invite him all over because he was civil.
Yeah.
And
engage in debates and all.
Yeah, and you'd see, you know, civil debates between two religions. Right? And this guy really believes in religion. He doesn't.
Yeah.
Good
point.
So we need a debate between him and his governor?
Brother Hitchens.
Oh,
is that right? Yeah, Hitchens.
There was a couple
of
debates.
Is that right?
Yeah, his brother's a believer.
I know. Well, when he died, when he tried to keep him very long dead.
This young lady back here had a comment, question?
Yes. I took philosophy of natural sciences from Keith Gunter in Stanton. I know that he's retired now. He might be a good speaker.
Yeah, he's been here lots of times. He's been one of our regulars. But do you know if he's still interested in speaking post-retirement? I mean,
I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, that's a good idea, though.
Well, we can comment on it.
Have you tried having a panel or a type of debate?
We've had it twice as a summer event.
Once on
free will determinism, and the other on whether you needed to believe God to have an ethical life. Yeah.
If you have someone that can't come to back up, well, you've got to
we have half the debate. But you know, we were talking about the philosophy of mathematics. That reminded me of a friend of mine who was working on his PhD in mathematics. And he said, this abstract math, and Brian, you probably know a lot about this, some of these arguments among these faculty members in this mathematics were vitriolic and nasty, just like you would find in a political science department. You know, we tend to think about numbers as real concrete, and 3 times 3 is 9, and 6 times 4 is 24. But when you get into these, you get these arcane theoretical areas of mathematics or physics.
Yeah, Jim can really talk about that.
Jim can.
But he's got T-shirts for it too, whatever.
Yeah, and so, you know, and you know, we talk about mathematics. Mark Twain says there's 3 kind of lies. There's lies, damned lies, and statistics. And in my business, I'm in the risk management and insurance business. You can manipulate numbers right and left. You can get them to sing whatever song you want them to sing. And so, reserves and all that. So then it gets into what really is, which is an area of interest of mine, what really is a fact? You know, what do we mean by fact? And what do we mean by theory? And what do we mean by scientific law? And facts can change. And that can happen in the mathematical realm, science realm, any realm.
Yes. Getting any speaker that's well versed on Karl Popper.
And
I think it would be a very interesting thing for everybody.
Yeah.
That's been one of the big watershed. You know,
Karl Popper. Yep.
Yeah. Of the philosophy of science and what is real science.
Right.
Really, you can see the.
Yeah.
Or Kuhn.
Oh yeah, Thomas Kuhn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or we could have someone stand up and read Kant. I'd understand it the same amount.
In German.
In German.
In German.
Okay, what other ideas? Anything else?
Yeah, well, Jared? I'm trying to kick my habit of watching pro football. I'm getting tired of the knocks. So I've substituted another addiction.
Yeah.
Dancing with the Stars.
You think you're making your brain dead instead of watching
it? I thought you were going to give a dance, Siri. Well, anyway, thanks for coming out. I apologize again that our speaker didn't make it. Very, you know, family emergencies happen.
Are we going to try to reschedule him?
I'm not sure. I think we've had an issue before where...
Well, he wasn't able to... He scheduled and then he canceled before we put him on schedule.
But he canceled. He gave us more notice than before. So sometimes it's maybe just to move on. But anyway, we got some great ideas from everybody.
David, this is the second time he's canceled?
Well,
but he gave us a bunch more notice.
Yeah, it was long notes, but we still had to fill the holes.
Yeah, still had to fill the holes.
I see your
Yeah. But anyway, thanks again for coming.
I was genuinely interested in the advertised topic.
Anyway, we appreciate everyone coming out, and we'll be back in two weeks.
Yeah.
Right.
Who's our speaker, Williford?
Yes, Williford. Is it on the self?
It's on the
cell.
You have one
of those. Check the website. You have a cell. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Who all says they have a cell? Okay. Well, maybe we'll have a good day going on. But anyway, thanks.
Well, one more question. How many people here are, I mean, we set the time up so people would have like a half hour to 45 minutes after the lecture to hang around and talk. Is anybody really interested in hanging around and talking afterwards?
Not for
an hour.
Very long. I mean, it doesn't have to be for an hour.
Yeah.
30 minutes is probably good.
Okay, but I mean, the idea of having some time afterward to sit around and talk appeals to some people.
Well, yeah. People will often line up to talk to the speaker, and they'll end up talking to each other. They want to talk to the speaker, but they're obviously interested in sticking around.
Okay.
So
I don't think you really want to push it so that you're closing the formal part of the meeting right when the restaurant is closing.
Right.
And anything runs long, anything gets interesting, you're stuck with, they're going to kick us out.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, great.
We have to stay up.
All right. Thanks again, everybody. Good deal.
Interesting. Very interesting. We all
ever have Dr. Galbraith from the University of Dallas.
Yeah, what's the last name?
I don't remember that name.
I don't think so.
David Edwards, a political philosopher.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Are you a regular?
Yeah, if you have some contact info, get on the website.
I'm sure we can find him.
Okay, all right, that's cool. All right.